Session 164, June 23, 1965. The Early Sessions, Volume 4. Good evening, Rob. Good evening, Seth. Seth, impeding actions represent actual blockages of energy or of action, dead-end accumulations. In one manner of speaking, this does not mean that the action is terminated, however. It does mean that action is turned into channels that are not to the best interests of the whole personality. The energies appear concentrated and turn inward, affecting the whole system. They represent offshoots, again, not necessarily detrimental in themselves, but only when viewed from the standpoint of the other actions that form the personality framework. Such actions naturally possess all the characteristics of action in general, and therefore will seek other methods of materialization and expression. An attempt at discipline will be made. The structure will seem, that is, the impeding structure will seem, to maintain itself. The whole personality, at any given time, because of its nature and characteristics, has only a given amount of energy available to it in practical terms, though ideally speaking, its energy is not limited. However, a certain portion of energy practically available to it is therefore spent in the maintenance of this impeding action. It is obvious, therefore, that less energy is available to the personality for actions more beneficial to the personality system as a whole. This situation can be serious in varying degrees, according to the impetus and intensity of the original propelling cause behind the impeding action. If the impetus is a powerful one, then the impeding action will be of more serious nature, blocking up large reserves of energy for its own purposes. It obviously becomes part of the personality psychological structure, the physical structure, the electrical and chemical structure, invading to some extent even the dream universe. It is momentarily, literally accepted by the personality as a part of the self, and here lies its danger. It is not just symbolically accepted. I am not speaking in symbolic terms. The impeding action, as seen in an illness, for example, is quite literally accepted by the personality structure and by all corresponding systems as a portion of the self. Once this occurs, a conflict instantly develops. The self does not want to give up a portion of itself, even while that portion may be painful or disadvantageous. There are many psychological reasons behind such a psychological truth. For one thing, while pain is unpleasant, it is also a method of familiarizing the self against the edges of quickened consciousness. Any heightened sensation, pleasant or unpleasant, has a stimulating effect upon the consciousness to some degree. It is a strong awareness of activity and life. Where the stimulus may be extremely annoying and humiliatingly unpleasant, certain portions of the psychological framework accept it indiscriminately because it is a sensation, and a vivid one. This acquiescence to even painful stimuli is a basic part of the nature of consciousness and a necessary one. Even a quick and automatic reaction or withdrawal from such stimulus is in itself a way by which the consciousness knows itself. The ego may attempt to ignore or escape from such experiences, but the basic nature of action itself is the knowing of itself in all aspects, and in a basic manner, in a very basic and deep manner, action does not differentiate between pleasant, painful, or enjoyable actions. These differentiations come much later and on another level, and in a later evolutionary development. But because the personality is composed of action, the personality also contains within it this characteristic of action, in that it accepts all sensations as expressions of itself and does not discriminate between stimuli. Action accepts all stimuli in an affirmative manner. It is only when action becomes compartmented, so to speak, in the development of highly differentiated consciousness that such refinement occurs. I am not here saying that unpleasant stimuli will not be felt as unpleasant and reacted against by less self-conscious organisms. I am saying that less self-conscious organisms will rejoice even in their automatic reaction against such stimuli, because any stimuli and reaction represents sensation, and sensation is another method by which such action knows and expresses itself. I suggest your first break. Rob notes, Jane said she had experienced another concept feeling while speaking, as she had in the 149th, the 151, 153rd sessions. Unlike the others, however, this involved more of a feeling rather than any visual images, and made describing it difficult. It involved, Jane said, some kind of inner comprehension that she was learning something in a new way, as though some kind of undifferentiated sense was operating and soaking up information. The feeling of being inside a concept, she said finally, was as good a description as any. As she had mentioned before, she believes she becomes aware of such concepts when Seth is dealing with material that is difficult to put into words. Seth, on a very basic level, a consciousness with a self, but no conscious I, exists in the most minute division of consciousness. All action and all sensations and all stimuli are instantly and automatically and joyfully accepted, regardless of their nature. At this level, no knowledge of threat exists. Action at this level is conscious of itself, but the I differentiation is not definite enough to fear destruction or painful stimuli. Here we merely have action knowing itself, and knowing itself, it knows its basic indestructibility, knows its own oneness, and has no fear of destruction, for it is also part of destruction itself, from which further action will evolve. The complicated organism, which is the human personality with its physical structure, has evolved, along with many other structures, a highly differentiated I consciousness, whose very nature is such that it attempts to preserve the apparent boundaries of identity. To do so, it chooses between actions, for the very choice, or act of choosing, the ability to do so, represents the nature of identity. But beneath this sophisticated gestalt are the simpler foundations of its being, and indeed the very acceptance of all stimuli without which identity would be impossible. Without any acceptance of painful stimuli, the structure could never maintain itself, for the atoms and molecules within the structure constantly accept painful stimuli and suffer, even joyfully, their own destruction, being aware of their separateness within action and aware of their reality within all action and not having complicated I structures to maintain. There is no reason for them to fear destruction. They are aware of themselves as part of action, and therefore, through capsule comprehension, which we have discussed, the simple atoms and molecules are aware of their own basic immortality. All this is basic knowledge. If you would understand why the personality accepts even an impending action, or pain, or illness, as a part of itself, despite the ego's resistance to pain. We have yet to discuss pain and pleasure. However, the subject will be covered thoroughly in sessions dealing with the nature of the human personality. Now, however, you understand the reason why even an impeding action is literally accepted by the personality as a portion of the self, and why, therefore, efforts must be made that will coax the personality to give up any portion of itself if progress is to be made. Once the personality can understand that an illness has been accepted as a portion of itself, then even the ego will be an aid. Jane now took another long pause, noted Rob. Seth, we are also helped here by several characteristics of the personality, in that it is forever changing, and its flexibility will be of benefit. We merely want to change the directions in which it moves, or rather the direction in which some of its energy moves. It must be seen by the personality that the impeding action is a hardship on the part of the whole structure, and that this particular portion of the self is not basic to the original personality structure, but only adopted. The longer the impeding action is accepted as a part of the self, the more serious the problem. The impeding action or illness, however, is not a part of the basic personality structure or action gestalt, which is composed of action patterns formed since birth. Compared to this truly astounding structure, that is the result of memory of every atom and molecule, this impeding action is relatively unimportant. And when correct methods are used, it can be dislodged without too much difficulty. The particular nature of the impeding action or illness has much to do with its persistence. The whole focus of the personality can shift from constructive areas to a concentration of main energies in the area of the impeding action or illness. In such a case, the illness actually represents a new unifying system. Now, if the old unifying system of the personality has broken down, the illness, serving as a makeshift, temporary emergency measure, may hold the integrity of the personality intact until a new constructive unifying principle replaces the original. In this case, the illness could not be called an impeding action unless it persisted long after its purpose was served. Even then, without knowing all the facts surrounding the personality, you could make no judgment, for the illness could still serve by giving the personality a sense of security, being kept on hand, so to speak, as an ever-present emergency device in case the new unifying principle should fail. This discussion will necessarily involve us with the structure of personality and with the nature of what you call suggestibility. I suggest your break. Seth, it is therefore impossible to consider an impeding action, such as an illness, without taking into consideration the particular structure unifying devices, subconscious and conscious personality tendencies. In other words, an action cannot be judged as an impeding one without a thorough knowledge of the other actions that result in the makeup of any given personality. This is extremely important. To overlook this point is to risk the adoption on the part of the personality of a more serious illness. Unifying principles are groups of actions about which the whole personality forms itself at any given time. These unifying principles may change and do change, usually in a relatively smooth fashion, when action is allowed to flow unimpeded. When it is not allowed to flow unimpeded, following the patterns or channels of its expression that have been evolved by the personality, then various blockages of energy occur. With such blockups of inhibited action, small blockages occur frequently, and the blockages or impediments themselves must be understood, not as something apart from the personality, but a part of the changing personality. Indeed, oftentimes they serve to preserve the integrity of the whole psychological system and to point out the existence of inner problems. Often they serve temporary functions, leading the personality from other more severe areas of difficulty. I am not here saying that all illness is good. I am saying that illness is a portion of the action of which any personality is composed, and therefore it is purposeful and cannot be considered as an alien force that attacks the personality from without. This is an extremely fascinating area of study, and one that we shall pursue rather vigorously. The whole personality must be led to choose those actions which are of the most benefit to itself as a whole, and its integrity as a unit is determined by its choices in this matter. I will at various times use as an example your friend's ulcer, simply because the ulcer represents an excellent example of an impeding action or illness. It must therefore be clearly understood that an impeding action is a creation of the personality itself. The very effectiveness and nature of the personality and health of the personality is dependent upon the manner in which it handles its ability to choose between various kinds of action. Without the choice, there would be no personality. The exaltations and triumphs of the personality are as much a result of this ability to choose between actions as are its illnesses and disasters. In almost all cases, impeding actions are the result of a refusal to allow action to flow unhampered in certain directions. It seeks other outlets, and these outlets are caused by fear. I suggest a brief break, and then I will continue unless you prefer that we end the session. Rob, we'll take a short break. Seth, now, while it is basically true that the personality is composed of action, and that its very awareness and identity is a result of action, this is not meant to imply any negation of the psychological or psychic values, although these are also action. The personality structure can be studied from many viewpoints. We are now studying it in relation to its basic reality as action. While it may seem that the personality would be a result of a series of actions, this is not basically the case. The personality in actuality is a simultaneous action, that is, composed of actions within actions. Portions of it are conscious of its awareness as a part of action, and portions of it attempt to stand aside from action. This attempt forms the ego and is itself action. If illness were thrust upon action or upon the personality from the outside, then the personality would be at the mercy of outside agencies. Now, insofar as everything is basically action, the personality is affected by outside agencies, but in a most basic manner, it chooses those actions which it will accept or reject. An illness can be rejected by the personality. The habit of illness can be rejected. Illness is sometimes, in the overall, however, beneficial. A given illness, that is, may be beneficial. When action is allowed to flow freely, then neurotic rejections of action will not occur. And it is neurotic rejections of action that often cause unnecessary illnesses. For we will be involved here with a definite classification as to when an illness is beneficial and when it is detrimental. This will be most important. An illness is almost always the result of another action that cannot be carried through. When the lines to the original action are released and the channels opened to it, the illness will vanish. In some cases, however, you see, the thwarted action may be one with disastrous consequences, which the illness may prevent. The personality has a logic of its own. We will be involved for many sessions to come with these problems, for they are of basic value and practical value. We will then later discuss the manner in which the difference can be seen between a beneficial illness and a severely detrimental one. We will see how a temporary necessary illness can be greatly lessened and the symptoms minimized, while the illness is still retained as a temporary emergency measure and then gradually allowed to disappear when its presence becomes unnecessary. We will also see how an unnecessary and detrimental illness that does not serve such a purpose can be dismissed. I will now end the session, but it will indeed serve as a basis for many discussions concerning the relationship between action, suggestion, personality, illness, and health. My fondest regards to you both. Rob, good night, Seth.